I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:12, Wednesday, November 25th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I only have one word for you. Merch!
Hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, and let me be the first among the panel to wish all our listeners a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Bill. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and there's only two numbers I wanted to say today. 157, which is the number of days until next year's Kentucky Derby, and 168, which is number of days until I get my shirt.
Oh. Poor baby. John, you got to buy one.
It looks like it. Looks like I got to pony up.
We'll charge you $99.99.
Three payments of $99.99? Where do I sign?
Yeah, can't better than that. Shout out to Patty Wolf, our producer, for selling me this beautiful merch. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Keeneland will conduct a December digital sale in the digital sales ring on Tuesday, December 15th. Entries are now open and are open through Friday, December 4th. Visit KeenelandDigital.com for details. All right, so we do have some decent racing this week that we're going to get to, but unfortunately, living in America right now, the top story is continuously the COVID-19 outbreak, because we still have not gotten a handle on this thing 8.5 months later. And we had some big news north of the border as well as here in America as well. The first big news came Sunday when Woodbine was forced to cancel the last 3 weeks of its meet. That's because of the Ontario government's lockdown restrictions. Now, you know, we've spoken about this before, about how in America we've the racetracks and the racing jurisdictions have been able to kind of negotiate their way into running just without fans, because it makes no sense to be having training in the morning when there's hundreds of thousands of horses on the track. And then, you know, there's fewer horses on the track during the day. Got to let people make money. So I'm not too familiar with the particulars of the Ontario government lockdown specifics. Maybe John or Bill are, but that's a little bit of a bummer, you know, because Woodbine has had to start and stop a little bit this year. They also had to stop Sunday's card halfway through because of inclement weather. So that was a bummer as well. And I feel for John, because Helium was supposed to run in the Gray Stakes and he looked like one of the top contenders in there. So that sucks. We're sorry for John, and we're sorry for all the connections that weren't able to run on Saturday or for the last 3 weeks. But, you know, this is reality now. And in America, we've had a bunch of interruptions as well. We had Golden Gate Fields last week had to shut down because of a huge outbreak, had over 200 people test positive, which is just a staggering number, because what could there be, maybe 1,000 people who work at Golden Gate or live on the backstretch? That's a huge, huge percentage. And then yesterday, Parks had renounced late that there were 7 jockeys that were taken off their mounts. And now they've got to go quarantine because they tested positive for COVID. There's a couple other developments happening as well at Zia and Gulfstream Park. And I'm going to toss it over to you guys for reaction, but this is just, it's emblematic of what's going on in this country right now, where we don't have a handle on it, and people stop caring. You know, I'm not saying that that's why these tracks or these jockeys tested positive. Who knows? Like, maybe they were following all the protocols and it still happened, but you know, it's just, this is where we're at. And, you know, people are going to go have giant Thanksgiving get togethers and really have no regard whatsoever for the fact that there were 180,000 cases that were reported yesterday, over 2,000 deaths for the first time since May. And we've decided as a society that we don't care, and we're okay with this mass death and sickness. And, you know, it's a sucky thing to show to the world that how little we care about our fellow citizens. But that's my little rant, because it just makes me sick every single day. But getting back to the racing part of it, I'm wondering if you guys think that this will be a short-term thing, whether it's at Gulfstream or Parks or Woodbine, or whether you think this is going to continue for the next couple months.
Well, Joe, I think you hit the nail on the head. And a couple other thoughts. I mean, first of all, the big story of, or the biggest story among this is Woodbine. And but look at how Canada is treating the virus versus the United States. It's not just Woodbine. The Toronto Blue Jays had to play their games in Buffalo. The Toronto Raptors are going to have to play their games in Tampa, the Tampa St. Pete area. I mean, they're being very vigilant. They are Americans for the most part, can't come into the country. So I don't know if you could lump them in necessarily with what's going on in the United States tracks because of a different country and a country that, yes, I think is taking the coronavirus a lot more seriously than we are in America. And, you know, I just want to echo what you said. You know, has racing been taking its ability to race during this for granted? I think so. And is racing, like the rest of society, become complacent? Yes, I think so. And again, that's not to point fingers at the jockeys at parks or anything like that, because we don't know the details of this. But, you know, we're talking about Thanksgiving. And, you know, if I'll say right now, if we were going to talk about what we were thankful for racing, is that racing has done so well to run so much uninterrupted, or to have such a great run despite the COVID-19 crisis. And I just think that, you know, we see pictures coming out of different places and backstretches of people without not masks on. And, you know, we see racetracks where they're not supposed to have spectators, but yeah, you know, there really looks like there's a couple thousand people there. And yeah, I think that racing better be careful here. This is worse now than it's been at any time. And, you know, people are going to not vote for racing. They're going to vote for safety. The government is going to vote for safety. So I hope that this is the worst we see. Woodbine, Zia Park, Golden Gate Fields are the three tracks that have been shut down. However, Woodbine, there was a story in the Toronto Star yesterday. They're appealing to the government. They're hoping to get some of these dates back. So stay tuned on that. But yeah, I mean, horse racing, you know, just like you say at the end of every show, wear your damn mask, do the right thing, and let's not get complacent or take things for granted here because we can't afford to.
Yeah, I don't really have a lot more to add. I mean, you guys have absolutely hit out of the park as far as my feelings and what's going on, you know, not only in racing, but just overall the societal issues that we're having here in the United States. You know, kudos to Canada for recognizing what protocols they need to implement and for just locking everything down. And this is coming from a guy who had the favorite in the stake race, you know, two races before they canceled. I've never had that happen before. I've never had a race canceled due to weather and then not get rescheduled due to, you know, a highly infectious disease. But if Canada is doing the right thing and is going to be able to make sure that as a community, they're going to be healthier, then you got to take one for the team. And you have to recognize that running your horse isn't as important as making sure that everyone is safe and sound and healthy. You know, as far as what's going on with racing, other than, you know, the excellent points you guys added, I think this is really going to be a week-to-week situation when it comes to these racetracks and the fact that, you know, are they going to stay open or are they going to be able to keep things kind of, condensed in their respective, you know, backstretches. I don't have a lot of hope. I thought that last year or earlier in the year, I should say, you know, when everyone was, I think, more scared of the coronavirus because of the unknown, that everyone was being a little bit more practical and safe and conservative. And that's why the racetracks could go to their respective governments and say, hey, these are the protocols we're going to put in place. And if we put these in place, then can we have racing without fans? And that was okay. But I'm not as confident now with the numbers spiking the way they are and the situation the way it is, that that's going to be the case. We've gone ahead and actually spread out our racing operation instead of to two racetracks over the winter. Normally we just run in New York and in Florida. We've actually expanded and brought them out to four different racing jurisdictions with the hopes that, you know, at least one of them will continue to race. So that way you can have some inflow of cash, you know, while the other ones aren't. So we're just trying to get a little diversified, and we're going to run in Louisiana, Florida, New York, and Kentucky. And again, hopefully at least one of those will stay open at any given time. But I'm not as optimistic as I was about racing without fans as I was in, you know, say April of this year.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a good point that Bill brought up about maybe whether or not we've taken it for granted in racing that we've been able to run this whole time, because there was a while there at the beginning when the pandemic first hit, like 5-6 weeks or so, where there were really no tracks running. There were a couple, but for the most part, racing was shut down. And then I think, you know, legislators and governments finally came to their senses that if you're going to allow training, it doesn't make sense not to allow racing. And I would wonder about the Ontario government's stance on that, but it seems like they're being extremely strict. And it sucks. It sucks for the people at Woodbine. And I know Woodbine's had a lot of layoffs, and it's a really tough time. So it's not as if this is an easy thing for people to swallow. But speaking from an American perspective, I think it makes more sense to be safe than sorry with this thing. And it's so frustrating too, because it seems now like there's a vaccine around the corner. You know, when this first hit and we were all locked down and we were all frustrated in the first couple of months, and we were just watching the news and like kind of waiting for this to subside, the vaccine seemed a million years away. And now it seems like, you know, maybe a couple of months. It seems like it's in December. It's going to first be the first vaccines are going to be distributed. Now, whether or not that's going to get to mass distribution soon, we're going to have to see. A lot of it's going to depend on the competence of the government, which I don't have a lot of confidence in for the next 2 months at least. So it's frustrating because there is light at the end of the tunnel now. So it's like you've been through this whole time. You've been through like 8 months of this, and now you can't just wait like a couple more months to get this all over with. Like, that's, to me, is the really frustrating part, especially because it's worse now. It's worse than it was in the spring. I mean, it's not, thankfully, where I am and where we are, it's not as bad as it was in the spring, but overall in the country, it's worse than it was in the spring. And what John said, like the taking one for the team thing, it doesn't seem like that's something that America is capable of at this point. And, you know, we've made our stubbornness and our stupidity a virtue, unfortunately. It's now you have to take this stand that, like, come take my Thanksgiving turkey from my cold dead hands as you go and like almost kill your grandmother or maybe kill your grandmother, because you have to have this giant Thanksgiving, you know, get together. You can't just pass on it for 1 year because of the world being on fire around you. It's one thing to have people ignore the restrictions and the regulations. It's another one to defiantly, proudly say, I'm going to put other people at risk because I'm unwilling to sacrifice anything in my life. I think that sacrifice equals oppression. So that's something that's off the table for me completely. And it's I've said this before, but it's embarrassing. And I know we have a lot of international listeners, and they must be looking at us like, what the hell is wrong with you? You have 25% of the world's cases when you only have 4% of the population. You have thousands of people dying every day. And so many of your politicians and people are like, you're proudly putting everyone at risk. It's just, it's absolutely insane and staggering and stunning, and it won't stop being that way to me. And, you know, like I said, hopefully there's a vaccine around the corner, a month or two, a couple months away, and we can all get past this. But I'm never going to forget the way overall we treated each other as American citizens during this thing. And it's been disgraceful, and there's really nothing else to say about it. And I know I'm going off on a tangent here, but this is affecting everybody. So it's not as if, you know, this is something that can be isolated into like one, oh, here, we'll talk about it on this show and not on that show. It affects everybody. We're still here. We're still here in this Zoom meeting because of this, because we still haven't gotten a handle on it. Like, it affects everything, and everyone is so steadfastly ignoring the steps that we all know we can take to mitigate it.
Joe, the only thing I want to add to what you said, and I think all three of us are on the same page when we talk about the coronavirus as a whole, but honestly, if I were head of a government in some state, a governor or something like that, I would let racing continue. I think it should continue because, you know, the argument that you have to, these horses can't stay in their stalls in the morning. They do have to be exercised, and you do have to have the workers there. But I think racing doesn't realize, like with many things with racing, that, you know, we live in this own little bubble, and we don't know much. We don't really reflect on or really recognize what's going on in the world outside of this. You know, to give an example, so could they race at Golden Gate Fields? Yeah, I guess they could. But 200 backstretch workers there have the coronavirus. Now, I know it's a liberal state and everything like that, you know, blue state, but the government there, I think came down to the government in the city that Golden Gate Fields is in, they don't want to hear it. They said you have 200 people sick, you're closing. It's simple as that. And how many more, again, if we're not careful, how many more Golden Gate Fields will we have that, you know, where the government, if they're, you know, rational and want to do the right thing, will just say, well, I shouldn't say that because I said that it was irrational earlier, that they will think they're doing the right thing by telling racing to just shut down. So again, don't be complacent. Don't take things for granted. You know, we are seeing more dangerous signs now for racing proceeding than we saw back in March when this thing all started. And, you know, let's hope it's restricted to these couple handful of tracks that we mentioned. But, you know, every day we seem to open up the newspaper or read on the internet about some new fiasco and racing is going to have to close down at XYZ downs.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, yeah, like you said before, we were lucky, and it seems like we were taking this for granted that we can run through this thing, and you know, hopefully it's a short term thing in terms of racing, and because I think overall the tracks have done a good job, and I think that it's a credit to the sport that, you know, up until now we haven't had any major outbreaks on back stretches. We had a couple of smaller ones. There was one at Lone Star. There might have been one or two more, but overall, especially at the major tracks, we've avoided that kind of thing. And that's a tip of the hat to Naira and the Stronic Group and everybody that runs these major tracks that we've been able to avoid this. I think the protocols have been reasonable and smart. But yeah, there's no guarantee. Even though it makes logical sense that, you know, you should be able to run when you're training in the morning anyway, there's state legislators and cities, governments, and like they don't automatically get that. You have to be able to explain it to them. And like Bill said, like once there's an outbreak, they don't want to hear any of that. They know that there's a big cluster of people there and they want to shut it down. And, you know, we got to be very, very careful of what we're going to do in these next couple of months until the vaccine comes and you know, whether or not we're still going to be able to run. And I think, you know, John mentioned that Gulfstream is having jockeys who even go to other tracks in state have to go through a 7-day quarantine and test negative to come back and ride at Gulfstream. And I think that's the smart thing. And I think overall tracks have done the smart things in direct contradiction to the rest of the country.
Yeah, and Bill, you mentioned before, just then we put it to bed. Bill, you mentioned before that we are our own little bubble, and we don't really know, you know, as an industry, what's going on in the rest of the world, and vice versa. And I think for the most part, a lot of these tracks have been able to lock down and take care of their own community and address it. But in this heightened, you know, scary situation that we're in right now, I think that a lot of the legislators and people in power are going to say it doesn't matter. Let's just shut it all down and get rid of this spike. And that way my numbers look better. And that way I'm eligible for other opportunities, and, you know, we can move forward accordingly. So again, I'm not that optimistic. Usually I'm an optimistic guy. I'm not that optimistic that we're going to have continuous racing, you know, through the winter and the spring, you know, going forward.
So after a pretty slow weekend last weekend on the racetrack, we do have some big racing this weekend. Churchill Downs has their big Thanksgiving weekend card, highlighted by the Clark, which is going to be run Friday. Grade one, $500,000 race through 14 horses plus one also elder one. That's a theme, I think, in this week's racing. So if you're a bettor, it's pretty much a smorgasbord of big fields and lots of value. Like I said, in the Clark, there's 14 races. We have the Hollywood Derby on Saturday at Del Mar, has 13 horses. The Falls City has 9. The Hollywood Turf Cup on Friday at Del Mar has 14. The Seabiscuit on Saturday at Del Mar has 13 horses. The Comley on Friday at Aqueduct has 10. The Red Carpet tomorrow at Del Mar has 10. The Jimmy Durante on Saturday at Del Mar has 13 horses. So I don't remember the last time I've seen a weekend full of stakes races where the smallest field is 9 horses. It's a, you know, it's a welcome change for what we're used to, which is a bunch of 5 and 6 horse fields. But obviously the headliner is the Clark, and headliner in the headliner is Code of Honor. He's kind of had a bit of a lost 4-year-old season. He had that great 3-year-old campaign, won the Travers, won the Jockey Club Gold Cup, albeit by disqualification. I really had a terrific season, finished second in the voting to Maximum Security. And I suspect that if people could go back and vote again after knowing what we know about Maximum Security's controversies this year with Jason Service and all of that, I suspect a lot of people would switch their vote to Code of Honor. But nevertheless, he's had a little bit of a lost 4-year-old campaign. He did win the Westchester, but then he was 3rd in the Met Mile. He was 4th in the Whitney. He was 2nd in the Kelso. So not quite the 3-year-old campaign wasn't quite the springboard to a great older horse career, at least so far for Code of Honor. Not sure what's going to happen with him. This might be his swan song. I don't know if they're going to bring him back at 5. Maybe you guys know if Shug has said something like that, but draws the 3-hole, should be a pretty big favorite in the Clark. But like I said, 14 horses, no superstars, but you know, any kind of 14 horse field, it might get a little tight for him at some point. It'll be interesting to see if he can get back to his top form. But I'm wondering if you guys have any other thoughts.
Yeah, one other thing I want to mention, I hate to throw cold water on all your enthusiasm about the weekend, but there'll also be a very sad story this weekend. It'll be the last ever racing at Calder after 50 years being shut down, and racing in 2021 in South Florida will be exclusively at Gulfstream Park. So we hate to see that happen. On the Clark, Joe, I think that it's fair to say that Code of Honor has had a lost year. And I also think it's fair to say that they've really not shown a lot of confidence in him. Why didn't they run him in the Breeders' Cup? McGahey told me before the Kelso that he would either go in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile or the Breeders' Cup Classic. He gets beat in the Kelso. So again, I don't like the fact that the stable apparently isn't showing a lot of confidence in him. And, you know, he's got the buyer figures on the field, but, you know, I don't think this is a horse you want to bet on. He won't be a short price because of the big field. It's not like he's going to be 4-5 or anything like that. But, you know, it just hasn't been his year. Nothing's really gone right. And, you know, this isn't a Breeders' Cup Classic field, but it's good enough that, you know, if he doesn't bring his A game, he's probably not going to get it done. I'll give By My Standards another shot. I mean, he ran very poorly in the Breeders' Cup Classic. But before that, his form was very good. He was also a triple-digit buyer horse, finished ahead of Code of Honor in the Whitney. And he wouldn't be the first horse to just not show up in the Breeders' Cup and then do fine afterwards. And Bodhi Express is a little bit interesting, too, to me. He looks like the clear speed in the race. But, you know, this is a horse that doesn't win. Speaking of Calder, he doesn't do anything outside of Calder. That's where all his successes come from. So let's see if he can do it on another racetrack. But, you know, again, it's the cliche. It's a great betting race. Is it a scintillating grade one from a class and quality standpoint? No.
And I know I've said this before, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, but, you know, is the Clark really a grade one race? Should it be a grade one race going forward? You have 14 horses in this race, and save, you know, Code of Honor, there's not one grade one winner in here. And Code of Honor, you know, won a grade one. The last grade one that he won was the Jockey Club Gold Cup when he got, you know, when the winner got DQ'd and he inherited the victory in that one. Now, he did win the Travers the race before. So, you know, you can say he is a legitimate grade one winner. But otherwise, there's, you know, good horses in here, but nothing that hit the board in any of the Breeders' Cup races, you know, migrated into this race. And I would not expect, you know, but maybe one or two of these horses going into the Pegasus in January if they're, you know, if they do well in this race. So it's the last big grade one race, you know, for males to close out the year. And it's a great focal point and betting race because there are 14 horses in here. But to me, it's just kind of a blah field. And I wonder, you know, I know there's a whole formula as to why races, you know, end up being a grade one, grade two, grade three. But my understanding is that part of it is that if the horses that race in that field, you know, continually hit the board in other graded stake races or other grade ones, that adds, additional cachet and additional value to making the Clark a grade one again. So, to me, it's just kind of it's a great betting race, but if it wasn't a grade one, if it was just a $500,000 race, I wouldn't think twice about it, you know, not being graded.
Yeah, not even graded. Wow, we're going that far. We'll make it a list.
Well, you know what I'm saying. I mean, it's definitely not a grade one, at least. Okay.
But no, I mean, it's in a tough part of the calendar, I think, because it's so close to the Classic. But then you also have the Cigar Mile, and you didn't mention that, Judd. To me, that's the last big grade one for older horses on the dirt. And so the Cigar Mile is a week or two away. And then you have the Pegasus as well, the advent of the Pegasus. A lot of people put their horses away after the Classic. And then the next thing they're going to point to is the Pegasus. And even that, like, is in a tough spot on the calendar because, you know, it's a little close to breeding season. And if you're going to bring a horse back after the Classic, a lot of times you're going to want to give them more than just a month or two off. So it's the Clark is really definitely getting squeezed here. Like I said, it's a great betting race. I'm a little more excited about it than you guys apparently. But it might go the way of the Stephen Foster. Stephen Foster used to be a big grade one handicap race at Churchill. And then, you know, it used to get like real, real top horses. That used to be the landing spot, I think, for a lot of horses after they came back from Dubai. But it's just gotten weaker and weaker fields over time. And now that's a grade two. So that might happen to the Clark as well. But overall, it's a good weekend of racing at Churchill. And I just wanted to mention the Hollywood Derby real quick, which is Saturday night. You have the Christophe Clement duo of Gouffo and and Decorated Invader, obviously, friend of the show, Terry Finley. We're going to talk to in a little bit about him. But you also have some other pretty nice horses. Get Smokin', who won the Hill Prince last time at Belmont. You have Domestic Spending, who won the Saratoga Derby. Smooth Like Straight is a really interesting horse for Mike McCarthy. He's a speedball. He's stretched his speed out to a mile and an eighth before. We'll see how much pressure he gets from the outside from Get Smokin', and a couple other horses. Storm the Court, poor Storm the Court is in there, still looking for that additional win after his championship 2-year-old season. But I think that's a really interesting field as well, and I'm interested to see the kind of clash of coasts with Smooth Like Straight going against the powerful Christophe Clement duo and then Chad Brown's horse as well. So lots of good racing if you like to bet. If you were looking for the huge name horses that, you know, you might have seen in the Breeders' Cup, obviously that's not going to happen. But if you're a better this weekend, I think you're going to find some opportunities to take a dive.
Yeah, this to me is actually a really, really interesting race, especially with Christophe Clement. When he was on the show, you know, months ago, he actually indicated that he wanted to keep his two big horses, Cafo and Decorated Invader, separated, except for a couple of big races. And I think he's been successful in doing that. The only time they ran against each other was in the Saratoga Derby, and they finished within like a half a length of each other. You know, Cafo finishing second and Decorated Invader finishing fifth, but losing overall to the winner by 3/4 of a length. And you mentioned a lot of the other, you know, big items in here, Smooth Like Straight. Strong Constitution, I thought, was an interesting local horse of Doug O'Neill's that they tried long on the turf last time and granted a restricted stake race that he won. And then, Joe, also California Kook, who may or may not run. She's been cross-entered in two different races. But a 3-year-old filly that Peter Miller has entered in the race, I think just to see what the race would look like because it is a grade one race. So to me, this one is actually a really interesting betting race as well as just from a fan standpoint.
Yeah, definitely not a bad race to watch on your Saturday night. Also later today, Dennis's Moment is coming back. That's interests me at least on this Thanksgiving Eve because we thought he was the top 2-year-old in the country last year, regardless of what happened in the juvenile. And we thought he was going to be the top 3-year-old this year, but he's only run once and it was a disastrous effort in the Fountain of Youth. So I'm interested to see how he runs as well at Churchill. So even though there wasn't a ton of high-class racing over the weekend, especially with the races at Woodbine being canceled, there was a high-class 2-year-old that debuted for Bob Baffert. Yet another Bob Baffert monster, yet another Into Mischief monster named Life is Good. $525,000 Keeneland September buy. He debuted at 1-5 on Sunday at Del Mar in the second race and just, you know, popped out of there and never looked back, was blazing through really fast fractions like 21-4, 44-4.
Life is Good and his debut comes to the final furlong with a 6-length lead. And then it's wiped the slate on the outside and Santos to Wilson. Life is Good. Really, really, really good. Oh my, he won it by 8 lengths in style.
You don't see horses typically go that fast at Del Mar, going 6 furlongs, but he was just crazy, crazy impressive. Obviously a no-brainer, slam dunk, TDN rising star. Bill, I think, has some thoughts about him as well.
Well, I can add to it, he ran a 90 buyer figure. And no, I mean, there's not a whole lot to add to it. We've seen this story so often. I mean, where does Baffert come up with all these horses? I mean, it's just an endless parade of these monsters that come in. You know, obviously he's got a lot more to prove, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he won the Kentucky Derby. I mean, how could you be? He's got the breeding. His first race was absolutely sensational. And, you know, we've got another one from the same guy again and again and again to look forward to in the 2021 races. Did see that he said he hasn't really picked out a next spot for him. So I guess he's not going to go in the Los Alamitos Futurity, which I thought was a possibility. But, you know, it'll surface next year at Santa Anita and it'll be 1-5 again in some stake or allowance race. And we'll all be very excited to see what he can do. I mean, there's nothing about this horse not to like. He was sensational.
And aptly named. I mean, Life is Good. Life is good for the horse. Life is good for the owners. And life is certainly good for Bob Baffert with another just monster coming out of the, you know, out of his barn. And granted, we have to temper the enthusiasm a little bit because it was a 5-horse field. 4 of them were first time starters. But man, the horse broke and spooked a little bit. And, you know, give Mike Smith a lot of credit for not immediately, you know, putting the foot on the brakes and, you know, scaring the horse. He just let him relax. and was really never asked and won in a hand ride and, you know, 109 and change for six furlongs and just coasted the 115 and two, you know, going six and a half. So, there's, like you said, there's not really much else to say about him until he starts running against bigger fields and tougher fields, which probably won't happen until early winter out in California. But he's definitely a horse to watch.
Yeah, it might be a little too fast for his own good. That's the only potential flaw I could see. It's when you go that fast that early. I don't know. Baffert obviously has gotten plenty of horses the Derby that are fast, but I wonder if he might be a little bit better going shorter in the future. I just always wonder about horses that just show that much speed. Talk about races that might get downgraded. The Los Al Futurity and the Starlet. I mean, those are races that are kind of like hanging on to their old Hollywood Park prestige. And they always get like four or five horse fields. I don't know that those are legitimate grade ones, especially if Bob Baffert's going to pass on a race like that with a horse like this. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
All right, so there was a little bit of movement the past week or so with the New Jersey Racing Commission and fixed odds wagering potentially coming to New Jersey. But Bill knows more about this than me, so I'm going to let him explain the developments.
Well, yeah, Dennis Drazen and the Monmouth Park people for some time have wanted to get fixed odds wagering going. And, on the surface, you could say this is definitely a good idea because you ought to try these. No doubt about that. And also, it would ease the pain of seeing a horse at 7-1 go into the gate, open up by four and pay $8, which is something that just, you know, we all want to tear our hair out. So what is going on right now is that there's a bill that's been put forward that will allow fixed odds wagering next year in New Jersey. Just, you know, blanket allow it. And then I don't know quite why they decided to do this, but I guess in case that bill doesn't get through in time, the Jersey Racing Commission gave them permission. This is very odd to me. To take fixed odds wagering on grade one races outside of New Jersey. So if they could get into agreement with Churchill Downs, obviously they take the Kentucky Derby and that. I really applaud racing, especially Monmouth, for trying this because we can't try enough new things. It would take care of some of the problems with the horses, the odds drops going down. But looking back at the Betfair example, which is, went up in flames and really never went nowhere and was a form of fixed odds wagering, I just wonder if this is not a product that Americans have an appetite for. You know, these things work in Europe where that's all they do is bet win on horses. Everybody in America now wants to put, $25 into the pick five and win $5,000. So, I think Americans' tastes are different than people from overseas. So I'm not really sold that this is going to be a success. I hope that it is because I think it could be something to be very successful for wagering and racing and really move it forward, maybe get more sports bettors. But I'm a little skeptical that this is going to work.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And you hit the nail on the head that, the Betfair experiment was fixed odds wagering. Now it was peer to peer. There wasn't one bookmaker shop that was setting all the wagering odds. And so maybe that's different if you have like a central ADW or whatever that's setting the odds and you can have more liquidity, more guaranteed liquidity in the pools. But yeah, that was tried and it failed. But I think part of the reason that it failed was because it was so localized, because there were so few tracks that were offered on the Betfair exchange. But yeah, I mean, it's a fair point to ask whether or not this is something that American bettors want. I certainly would like it. And I think most sophisticated bettors would want it. Because parimutuel wagering, at least on the win end, I think has become a little bit of a thing of the past in the rest of the world. But, in Europe, they've been doing fixed odds wagering forever. That's the baseline in terms of how they bet on the horses. So it's as if you would try to introduce parimutuel wagering into European pools. And I think it would be less popular than fixed odds wagering because that's what they're used to. I think, that's possibly the case here. I think it would be a great thing, but it's going to be so localized and so small. You know, if they get the bill passed in New Jersey to do fixed odds wagering on Monmouth races, and then they have this small carve out to do bets on out of town grade one races. And even that, like, I don't know how that's going to work out, how the tracks that are running these grade one races are going to get a cut of these bets. It doesn't seem like they're going to take that lying down and be like, yeah, sure, you can make your money off of our races and not give us any revenue. That doesn't seem like, you know, it seemed like too possible for the future. But yeah, I mean, if this is one of the things where if we had like a unified racing commission where we could actually try it, there could be like a nationwide pilot program and you could see once and for all whether or not the American bettor has an appetite for fixed odds wagering. Because if that were the case, I think you might be surprised at how many people would opt for it. But because it's such a small slice of the betting market in America, even if everything that Dennis Drazen wants to do, and I give him a tip of the hat for trying new things, but even if he gets everything he wants, it's still such a small part of the overall market that it's going to be hard to catch on, especially with the way that Betfair fizzled out. All right, so since it is Thanksgiving Eve, and we want to wish all of our listeners and our viewers a happy Thanksgiving, we wanted to go through this with John's idea. He's such a softie. He's so sentimental. We wanted to go through it and talk about some of the stuff that we're thankful for as racing fans, as analysts, as media talking heads. So I got a couple. I'll start, and then I'll pass it over to these guys. One thing I'm thankful for is that racing, I think, has had a greater spirit of cooperation this year than I've ever seen in my life as a racing fan. And it started a lot with the sales companies when the coronavirus hit, and they stopped like elbowing each other out of the way and decided, hey, let's make a cohesive, cooperative schedule for the year so that we're not stepping on each other, so that everybody can get their opportunities at all these different sales. And I thought that was a really good kind of a benefit of coronavirus, honestly, is that it kind of forced the sales companies and racing to be a little bit more cooperative. And I think you're going to see more of that over time, because it's honestly cooperate or die at this point in racing. We don't have a booming enough business for everyone to be stepping on each other's toes. I think that, you know, and also on that note, I just thought about this, but Martin Panza, when we had him on the show, and he was talking about how they managed to, you know, do the Belmont Stakes schedule and have the Belmont in the middle of June. He was talking about, like, you know, wanting to make it work with the rest of the Triple Crown schedule and the rest of the racing schedule. So I think you do see a lot more of that these days in racing than you used to. I'm thankful that we were able to run through most of the year. Now, it's maybe that's a little bit soon to say that, because we'll see what happens in this last month or so of the year. But it seemed, like I said before, that we weren't going to be able to run back when the virus first hit. And, you know, unlike a lot of sports, we were able to, you know, people were able to make their living basically all through this thing. So I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for the movement on drug policy. I think that's something that's, you know, I think that's the biggest story of the year in racing, is the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, which seemed like a huge long shot just a year ago. Now seems like it's almost a lock to get through Congress, and we're finally going to have a unified drug policy and enforcement. And I think that's such a huge thing, and that's the core of a lot of problems in racing, is that we have such fractured drug policy. So I think that's a big deal, and that's something to be very thankful for, and something to be hopeful for the future. And lastly, I want to be thankful for our viewers and our listeners. We're still here after 64 shows. We're obviously doing something right. And I want to thank all of you for watching and listening, and hope you have a safe and happy Thanksgiving.
John, I just want to repeat what I said earlier and also repeat some of the things you said. I think the number one thing that everybody in racing should be thankful for is that we had a Saratoga, that we had a Del Mar, that we had a Breeders' Cup, that we had a Kentucky Derby. I mean, we were doing these shows back in the middle of March, early April. There was no guarantee of that. And I think somewhat of a pleasant surprise for the sport. So, you know, horse racing came out of this so much better off than many industries, including the major sports. I mean, look, baseball only had a 60-game season, that sort of thing. The NBA had to go to the bubble format in Orlando. So, I mean, of all businesses and all sports in general, horse racing did a lot better than most. And that's because of its unique nature, where you don't really need to have fans in the stands because of all the ADW betting, et cetera. So, but it goes back to what I said earlier in this, let's not take it for granted. That doesn't mean we're home free for now. But that is what I think everybody in the sport should be most thankful for.
And aside from the great points you guys bring up, I'm actually thankful for the indictments. I'm thankful that somebody outside of our industry shone a tremendous spotlight on us and said, you guys aren't doing this right. We're here to help. We're here to make sure that we can root out people who are taking advantage of the rules and basically taking money out of your pocket and food off your table. So as silly as it sounds, I'm actually very appreciative that the indictments came down and it started this movement of cooperation that Joe mentioned, and as well as the, you know, hopefully gave the emphasis for the, or the impetus, excuse me, for the unified medication rules to get all these jurisdictions together and say, this is the way we're going to do things going forward, whether it's Lasix or clenbuterol or you know, whatever drug you want to fill in. Let's make it a uniform rule. Let's make the testing harder and better. So that way the people who are winning at 7 and 10% and doing it the right way and coming out every morning at 4 a.m. to take care of the athletes that they love and care for, that they have a fighting chance. So that's one of the things that I'm thankful for. I'm thankful for young sires like Not This Time, Constitution, and Nyquist adding new blood to the industry and giving us, you know, some hope that there are some young stallions that are going to be taking the place of some of these recently retired and pensioned stallions that have done it for 15, 20 years. I'm also very, very thankful for you guys for this show, because you make me work hard at making sure that I know what the hell I'm talking about, which isn't an easy thing to do on a lot of topics, whether it's breeding or racing or medications or, you know, betting combinations. Every week I look forward to the show, and every week we put, I know I'm not the only one, we all put hours and hours of homework into making sure that we can give our viewers a great show. And I'm very, very proud of that. And finally, from a personal standpoint, I'm very, very thankful for the undefeated yearlings that we have in the barns. And God willing, one of them is going to be an Oaks or Kentucky Derby winner in 2 years.
Writer's room.
Woohoo! Writer's room, the New York bred. That's right.
Yes. When we come back, we're going to speak to Terry Finley of West Point Thoroughbreds. Terry is also on the board of the New York Racetrack Chaplaincy, whose Christmas drive is underway to help the families of the New York backstretch celebrate the season. Learn how you can help right here.
In my time around the backstretch, it's been apparent to me that the backstretch chaplaincy is really part of the backbone of the racetrack and what they do for people, the care. There are no bounds, no limits to what they will do for the people of the backstretch in terms of improving their quality of life. And I fully intend to support their Christmas charity and their pledge and to support a family.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week, I feel like, is an overdue guest to have on our show. One of our wonderful sponsors, West Point Thoroughbreds, the founder, president, and CEO of West Point, Terry Finley. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Great to be with you guys.
Great to have you. All right. So this is going to be, I think, a little bit more of an informal discussion than our usual Q&A, because you're a guy that I think we want to get a lot of opinions on about what's going on in racing. But I'm going to start with a question. This is a question I ask a lot of people on this show who are in the ownership business. You obviously have some people, I would assume, over the years that are new to racing, that you introduce into racing through West Point. Is there anything that you've learned from that experience that you think is instructive in terms of how racing can better market the sport to newbies?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think that there's a single answer. What we've come to is it depends on the person, and there's no magic bullet. So, we realize it's every person and you're doing it and introducing a new person one by one. So there's not a marketing program or like an app or, a computer program that's going to do it. So you really have to tailor it to each individual person, because, some people are really intrigued by the breeding business. The vast majority of people are intrigued by the racing business, but I think the fact that we work hard to try to understand and to get to that point to identify what has piqued their interest, I think has been good for us. And I just suggest that to other people that ask me, you know, about the marketing side, is it's all about one by one. So that would be my response to that question. You know, it's a tough nut, but we know that. But overall, I do think we're doing a better job as an industry attracting people both to, you know, the betting side of our game and the ownership side of our game, which we all know are the two forces that drive our business.
Hey, Terry, thanks for joining us. And you wear so many different hats. I want you to put on your NYFA hat now, New York Thoroughbred Horsemen Association. And one of the big stories of the year is the Horse Racing Safety and Integrity Act. And some horsemen's groups, particularly the National HBPA, have come out dead set against this. NYFA has supported it. So I wanted you to speak on behalf of NYFA why they believe it's the right thing to do and right way to go for racing. And also, if it inevitably or at some point in time means a entire abolition or banning of Lasix, race day Lasix, which is probably going to happen, would you be okay with that as well?
Well, Bill, you know, that's like a point. I got to tell you, I am very proud of the NYFA, the board, and I know John Green. I'm actually stepping off the board at the beginning of December, so I just cast my vote for John Green, and there were four other good candidates. Actually, there are eight or nine owners that are running for the board. So, you know, all very, very good candidates. You know, there are five trainers, so all of them are going to get on. So Chad and Joe Applebaum Chad Summers and Joe Applebaum are running against each other. I support Joe Applebaum. You know, I think he's done a wonderful job. He, you know, his first term was as a board member, and then in 2017 he took over the presidency. And you know, I think the good thing is we always haven't looked at everything exactly alike, which is, you know, what you should want on a board. But I think he's had, and I think he's shown, and he has the right temperament to lead the horseman's group, right? Because it's a no-win job. You know, he puts an incredible amount of time and effort. And I always say, I'm going to try to get you a pay raise. Well, the pay is zero. But, you know, Joe is, you know, one of the rising stars in the business. And I think great things ahead for him. You know, and so Joe and I think that was – you know, a subject that we didn't look exactly the same at, you know, the Horse Racing Integrity Act. And I know Joe and the other leaders of the horsemen's groups around the country, a good number of them, they pushed for the safety component. And I think that was a really, really good addition. So overall, I think that the Horse Racing, the Safety and Integrity Act today, right, vis-a-vis 2 years ago, is a lot better. So I think that's one thing. You know, I think one of the, you know, the real covenants of a good leader is to evolve and to take the changes with the actual subject that you're looking at, in this case, the federal bill, and the circumstances, and the community and the industry. And I think the leaders, right, that have coalesced in support of the act that at one point in the past they weren't in support, I think they've shown great leadership. I really do. So I'll address that, you know, that side of it. And I think the Lasix, like, I think for the most part, you know, people want to try to win races and they want to do it on a level playing field. And I know Lasix is important to a good segment of the industry, but I think the compromise, right, that the jockey club and the major tracks and the horsemen's group that have come up with, you know, to not allow the drug to be used for 2-year-olds and in 2021, you know, to get it out of stake races, right? So the meat and potatoes horses and the races, you know, in the middle of the week, right, they're still going to be on Lasix. And so, yes, I know what the covenant says in the bill, that in 3 years, right, there'll be a period of time where everybody well, I have a chance to evaluate it. And my hope is that that's the case, is that, that it's going to be clear enough where everybody will see either we shouldn't get rid of it and we should still keep the claimers on, or we have a chance to get away from it. I think a lot like the vast majority of the people in the business, there are bigger and broader challenges that we have to address. And quite frankly, I'm so glad that we've gotten away from, it's all about Lasix. It's all about Lasix, because I think we know now, and it's crystal clear that it hasn't been about Lasix. It's about trying to give owners the chance to play on a level playing field and to attract people, right? Because people don't want to be embarrassed. You know, you look at the sportsmen in our game, you know, the people that could be doing anything with their wherewithal and their wealth, and they come into the business and they give us all a chance to show that we're doing everything we can to give them a fair shot. And I think we're starting to, you know, to really catch their attention in a sensible way. And I'd like to think that we're on the way to continuing to grow. So I say that in a general way. I'm optimistic that we're on the right track, but I do appreciate, you know, that a number of people and organizations have come to the table and they've compromised. And you know, when we've done that in the past, you know, good things have happened. And I really think good things are on the way for us if we stay at the table and we don't get mad at each other. Like I've kind of learned, like, you get frustrated. I say you in a general sense. I think we all get frustrated at the pace of our change in the business. But that's the way society works. You know, we just have to accept the fact that it's an, you know, it's all about an evolution, and you know, things don't change quickly in the vast majority of industries, and our industry is just the same.
And Terry, we mentioned that you're going now from the NYSTA board, where you implemented and spearheaded a lot of wonderful things with backstretch support and the promotion of the chaplaincy group, medication and safety rules, and now you're I'm going to say graduating to the Jockey Club board. What are some of your top goals for the first 100 days while you're at the Jockey Club?
Well, John, I was elected. I had the honor of being elected to the Jockey Club in the middle of 2019. So it's been a thrill. It really has. And, you know, the Jockey Club of today is, you know, a lot different than the Jockey Club of say 1980. So if you look at the people that have been elected, say, over the last 3 or 4 years, and you see the diversity and you see the different quote unquote the profile of the people that have come on. And I think it's a dynamic board and a group of leaders, and I think they're doing great things. Obviously, you know, not everybody in the industry agrees with every move that the Jockey Club makes. But I do know that, you know, when I've looked at the things they've done and the things that they have in the chute, right, they're always doing the harder right over the easier wrong. And they're not always looking to be popular. And, you know, John Lewis, the congressman who just passed away, was, you know, really a hero of mine. And he used to say, leaders lead. They don't lead with taillights. They lead with headlights. So I'd like to think that the Jockey Club, you know, they're not leading with taillights, right? They're trying to lead every day and on every subject, you know, going forward with headlights.
I wanted to ask, you know, we were talking a little bit before about the indictments and how big of a story that was in racing earlier this year. I was one of the ones when we had that podcast afterwards that I think we all did, but I was especially annoyed at some of the owners who were trying to abdicate responsibility and act like they had no idea what was going on. I wonder about your thoughts on the responsibility of owners to clean up the game, because it's easy, you know, after these guys get indicted to throw them under the bus and pretend like they were rogue actors and all that. But most likely the owners knew what was going on, at least to some extent. And you're a guy who uses, you know, old school guys who we are pretty sure aren't doing anything untoward. Dallas Stewart, Tom Albertrani. I wonder what your thoughts are on the responsibility of ownership in this sport to clean it up.
So I thought that question would come up. So I took a look at our stats. I think over, you know, the last 30 years, I don't know, we've had about 52 or 5,300 starts. And I don't think we've ever had, a positive test. If there was, it was probably 15 years ago with an overage or, you know, some insignificant issue. But it's a tough deal. It's a tough deal. You know, the last thing anybody wants to do is to point fingers and to try to be a sour loser. You know, that's not part of our culture. And I struggle with it. And I don't think it's, you know, going to get any better. You know, we can see there are situations now that I think are getting close to the situations that we saw with Jason Service and all the trainers that got busted and are in the legal system right now. And it is frustrating, you know, but all right, so that's, you know, in the past and the present. So let's take a look at the future. You know, I think artificial intelligence, I think some of the things that the Jockey Club is doing and, you know, other organizations, I think USADA, a big part of the Horse Racing Safety and Integrity Act, I think they're going to be able to do a better job, with the pinpoint accuracy and to bring the forces to bear to identify the people who, you know, just are, you know, the data shows that it just can't be, right? And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about situations that just can't be credible, if you will. And so, I there's no easy solution there. We just have to keep the pressure up. And I just say to owners, right, you have to stand for something. Like, that's why I'd go around the country and I would say, I'd talk to owners and they would say, I don't want the federal government in. I don't want oversight. They can't do anything. I said, so what do you propose? I said, so what is your solution? Right. Because you can't complain about things and, you know, trainers can't be up on the rail in the morning ranting and raving about this guy cheating. You know, that vet's a cheater. And then on the flip side, not have an option and a way to address it. And that's what I think the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act does. So I would just say, if any endeavor in life, in the history of the world, if there's any money involved, you're probably going to have cheating and you're going to have people who are going to try to cheat. So look, I'm in the syndication business. I'm not in the legal business. I'm not in the law enforcement business, but I do know that there's an ongoing issue that I think is going to get better now. And I think it's long overdue, like we all do. Right. Everybody has the right to be looked at and to be given a fair treatment. So I don't know if I addressed that, you know, everybody kind of tiptoes around this. I do too. Some days I don't feel great that I'd love to come out and say, this guy's cheating, that guy's cheating. And I know
we would love to do that too.
Yes. But I will tell you, I really hope that there are some trainers and there are some vets and there are some other, you know, people in our industry that haven't slept in the last 8 months, right? Cause they're waiting for that phone call. And the superseding indictments, you guys have done a very good job, you know, keeping this issue at the fore. Cause look, we've had a lot of things happen since the spring and, but it's starting to come back into plain sight. And look, we got to take our medicine. We let it happen. We, as an industry, we let it happen. And, you know, I just, you shake your head. But, you know, the thing is, I don't think it does any good to be frustrated and to think about what we did. And look, when I look back, I think we got beat in 7 graded stake races by those 2 turkeys, either Jason Service or Navarro, where we finished 2nd or 3rd. You know, there might be some other people, but I think we were probably towards the top of the list of being adversely affected by that. So, you know, when I've talked to people in the last 8 months about the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, I said, listen, like, they've taken money out of my pocket and my partner's pocket. And there's no doubt, right, that we've lost partners in the last 8 months, because they said, like, you know, the industry has had a long time to clean this up. And now, you know, they finally do it. And I will tell you, I was very proud of the job that the Jockey Club did. And I know I'm on the Jockey Club, but I'll tell you, that doesn't happen. You know, the indictments don't occur unless in, what, 2016, they hired 5 stones, and they, in essence, they put a bow on this and they gave it to the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor. So, look, I know it took all segments of the industry, but the Jockey Club, I think you know, when they do something, you know, and they do it right and they get it right, I think they're owed the credit. And I do. I appreciate the leadership of Stuart Janney and Jim Gagliano and the board, right? Because there are only so many things. I mean, they have the resources, but they're not unlimited resources. So I think they applied those resources in the right way. And, you know, I do know one thing, you know, people are thinking about what to do, or, you know, if they're talking on the telephone or they're texting and they're cheating, you know, they're giving it a second and third thought. And that's a big part of it, right? That deterrence. So, you know, we'll keep going, you know, the industry, and, you know, I know people get out of the business, but I don't think we are, and we're going to keep after this. And, you know, that's the only thing I can see that's going to be effective long-term, is to just, you know, stay vigilant and to try to identify these guys that are taking an edge and are cheating.
John, let me just jump in, Bill, a follow-up question. So, sure. Sorry, one of the other things that you can, that we've found that we can do as owners is when you're at the sales and, you know, when you look at the catalog page, does a light go on in your head and say, well, I'm not going to buy a yearling that's sired by a horse that was trained by a guy that I think is cheating, or out of a mare that I think is, you know, from a guy who's cheating, because maybe those credentials that those horses have aren't really viable?
Yes, John, that's certainly come into play, right? I don't think you or I, you know, we've been in the business probably about the same amount of time. I don't think we've had a scandal like this and indictments at this level. So yes, I think that's something that our generation can do, is to hold accountable, even if, right, there's collateral damage. You know, I know there's some farms that have some of the, or are ready to stand those stallions. You know, is it fair to penalize them? You know, in the long run, I think everybody's got to be held accountable. But, you know, I would think that the stallion managers, as they go forward, right, you have to be cognizant that there is some risk of the owners and the end users are going to hold that against you. So, you know, I think it'll work itself out. I don't think any one person, right, that's what I like, the fact, right, that no one entity can outmoney this game. So I don't think one person making a big stink about one stallion is really going to do a whole lot, except to get people pissed off. But, you know, we continue to talk about these things and to say and to put things on the table and to identify the horses that obviously performed at a level as a result of the cheaters. Yeah, I think before you know it, you know, people are very easily going to put 2 and 2 together. and the market and the people who are trying to do it right are going to take care of that. So I think that's a good point, John.
Terry, I sort of want to stay on the same subject. And one thing, I've said this already on the show, and I think most of us agree, horse racing is a very insulated world. And I think a lot of people in horse racing are guilty of not understanding how the people outside our bubble look and view the sport. And, you know, in your role where you try to get new owners, you'd be trying to appeal to people who may not have ever owned horses before. Even anecdotally told me a story once of going to Las Vegas with your classmates from West Point. So I think you, more so than a lot of people, would be in touch with both worlds, the inside world of horse racing, the outside world. So, I mean, it's a big question, but could you sum up how people view this sport right now when it comes to animal welfare issues, cheating of trainers, drugs, whips, etc.? What does the average man on the street, or what have they conveyed to you, is their image of horse racing?
Well, Bill, I would say it's probably better than it was 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago, in the midst of the tragedy and the terrible winter that they had out there. But I think if they spend any time and they do any bit of research, and they just don't take, you know, the evening news and a quote unquote, you know, hit piece on us, that they see that we're really trying. And I you know, there's a segment of society, no matter what, you could do everything and it, you know, you could be absolutely perfect and they'd still find fault. But the people who we want to influence and impact, I think by and large, I think they're reasonable. And all they want is for people to take these, you know, things that we know that we're not proud of as an industry, and that we take them serious. And I think we've shown as an industry over the last 2 years that we got our heads picked up, right? We basically did. We're like, if you didn't get your head picked up in the last 2 years, you probably need to be out of the game. So I think they appreciate that. And, you know, they're the people that I'm trying to focus on. And I'd like to think the people who are really care and they love our horses and they want to take care of our horses and they want to advance our industry, I think they're the people that we want to reach out to. And look, it's, you know, not going to happen overnight, but I think in time we have a shot to, you know, really positively impact those people. But we have a lot of work to do. And I remember that conversation, you know, that was in relation to the whip. I had 15 of my buddies and we were at the race book, Caesars, and you know, they were turning for home, and my buddy said, "Jesus Christ, Finn, they're beating the out of those horses." And I didn't have any response. And I've told some of the jocks that I really admire, and I've told some of the other people. So I think, you know, the good thing is with the, you know, say the whip, I'll zero in on that. I think it's, you're starting to progress, right? It's a very complex issue, and there are several different ways to look at it, but it's finally getting attention, right? And it's finally out in the open. And we if you're on one side, you've got to, you know, prosecute your case, and you have to put forward your line of thinking as to why you think there shouldn't be any changes, and why you think on the other side that there shouldn't be a whip at all, and all the other positions in front. And I think that's how you get progress, is when you're forced to prosecute the case that you're putting forward, you get advancements. And, you know, it's not going to happen as fast as a lot of people think, but I still think that's a problem. Like we don't really have a strong leg. I'm not saying we don't have a leg to stand on. I'm saying we don't have as strong of a leg to stand on as some people think, when, you know, we have our fans and our prospective fans and our prospective owners. They turn on TV, they see a high def right picture. They see a great program, the Fox program, and they're at Saratoga or Belmont, or they watch TVG. And man, this is a beautiful sport. And then they see a jock beating the out of a horse. I apologize for, you know, that's, I use that because a buddy used the term, but I struggle with that. I know like it's not going to go away. And I know there's right not an easy answer, but I just hope that that resonates with people that, you know, we can change and try to make this thing better, but we got to be able to give. We got to be able to a compromise. And I think if we do that and we're not looking to protect our positions from the past, and we're not looking at our personal agendas, we're looking at the greater good of our industry, we'll continue to make progress.
Terry, let's since we're talking about progress and evolution of the industry, let's talk about the way that West Point has revolutionized the industry. I remember coming into the business and the most talked about partnership at the time was Dogwood, where there were three partners and Cobb Campbell. And then you guys came in and totally changed and influenced the industry by having, you know, bigger partnerships and better horses. And now you can make the conversation that the micro share concept, whether it's in horses or in investing, you know, buying shares of Apple and micro shares, is now the new shiny opportunity for partnerships. Tell me a little bit about what your feeling is, because you're the foremost expert on partnerships and syndications.
Yeah. So I thought you'd bring that up, John. I really did, because obviously they won the Kentucky Derby, and actually they just won the stake the other day, right? The sprint stake. I can't pronounce the name of the track. Monterey Valley.
Right.
So like they're players. I remember Michael Behrens, he called me out of the blue like 3 years ago, you know, 4 years ago. He says, "Hey, I'm in the tech business. I've been a tech entrepreneur. I'm tired of, applicate apps." And I think he was in the mattress business.
Right.
And he said, I really love the game. I don't know anything about it. And I think I might have a new concept. And he did. And I said, look, and we met a couple of times. We met at Del Mar and we had dinner. And I just said, boy, there are a lot of legal hurdles here. And I didn't downplay it. I just said, look, I'm running my business. And man, I give him a lot of credit. He just kept after it every time. And we kept talking and he said, I'm getting closer. So one day I said, so is Christmas. but all of a sudden, you know, there it is, and I see them, they bought one horse and then two. And you know, all of a sudden they attracted the attention of Wayne Hughes. So, you know, very similar. I mean, like I just had my first grandson. And I just bought him a micro share. I opened a Schwab account and I bought like a sixth of a share of Apple. And I bought a couple other stocks, but they were micro shares. And I was laughing because I said, Schwab took the concept from myracehorse.com. And it's the way of the world. You know, we're at the beginning, when you look at Wall Street, and you look at, you know, before it was like you had to buy 1,000 shares of stock and you paid a big commission. And, E.F. Hutton, when he talked, everybody listened. And now, 60% of Americans actually have a brokerage account or are involved in the equity market. So I love it. I mean, we've actually got some people that have, bought into a myracehorse.com that have said, like, I want to have a different experience. And I think we've lost some people, that were probably, destined to become a West Point partner, but they ended up in a myracehorse and everything in between. But look, I think it's a great thing because when you compete and you have a competitive market and you have people trying different things, as we see, you want to stay in the game and I want to stay in the game. I want our company staying. You have to innovate. You have to be flexible. And you have to, every day you have to stay on top of the market. And when you do that, you get sharper, you're sharpening the saw. And I think it's given that not everybody's going to survive in the partnership business, but overall the industry will benefit because we know now, that the vast majority of people who own horses by themselves, the vast majority, when you either listen to them or you read about them, they've come in via a partnership vehicle of some sort. So it's a great thing. And I'll wrap this up by giving a final shout out to Cott Campbell. What a great mind and a great concept he had. And I can just imagine, you know, he didn't feel too good back in Saratoga when, you know, back in the early 70s, when he'd walk around and, you know, people will show their disdain, not really for him, but for the concept. And I'm sure it was frustrating for him. And I appreciate, and I really, really am grateful that he persevered, because we all owe it to him. And I think the sustainability of our industry in a large part, we owe to Cott Campbell.
You brought up My Racehorse and Spendthrift, and there's a certain sire at Spendthrift that I've heard is doing pretty well, and I've heard that you might have a connection to. Do you have an Into Mischief story?
Yes, I do. So I don't talk about it a lot because it's, right, there's a couple dollars between, but we bought, actually Buzz Chase bought for me. We were pinhooking a little bit then, not too much, and we actually don't pinhook anymore. But he said, I bought a Harlan for you. And he paid $92,000. And we sent him to David McCaffin in Ocala. And he said, yeah, he's a nice horse. He's a nice horse. So we sold him at the March sale for $180,000 to B. Wayne Hughes. And his name was Into Mischief. So, I think he, obviously I'm a big fan of the Spendthrift operation. They are formidable foes, and they've had such a great impact on the business. But I just saw Into Mischief, he broke the record, sire earnings for a single year. And look, I think it's pretty cool, in some respects, that we had our hands on that sucker. But I do know if I would have hit him at 190, and they didn't come back at 200, I don't think there's Into Mischief, right? Because we're not into the breeding business,
right,
per se. And I do know we wouldn't have retired him at the end of his 3-year-old year. So life happens, but I do know that, that $180,000, I don't know, B. Wayne uses turned into about $120 million. So we'll roll with the punches and we'll see if we can find another one.
That's why he's a billionaire, I guess.
That's a pretty good indication. He's a smart dude, he's a fun dude too. We've owned some horses together, and we've had some great laughs. And we're all the beneficiaries. And I say this, it's easy to throw platitudes and compliments, but we're all the beneficiary of Wayne Hughes and of the Spendthrift operation. Not everybody agrees with everything, but they've been innovators, and they've really been the entity that we've sorely needed, on that side of our industry for a long time. And I'm glad they're here. But they don't look like they're slowing down either. They bought a ton of yearlings. They bought those beautiful mares at the November sale. So, they're getting to a point where you pick up the overnight and you see those guys as the owner, and you're like, oh boy, we got some run. But that's all part of the business. You got to love to compete in our business, or you're going to get tired and worn out and probably leave the business. But I know the people that I'm involved with and that I like to run with, we like to compete every single day, and I wouldn't want it any other way.
You will be competing a lot this weekend. Before we let you go, I wanted to actually talk about some racetrack news, and we appreciate all of your insights on the industry at large. But you do have the Big Horse coming back on Saturday, Decorated Invader, looking for his second Grade One win in the Hollywood Derby. How do you feel about him this weekend? And then also, I know you've got a couple of other horses you're looking forward to seeing run this weekend.
Yeah, so Decorated Invader has been a very cool horse for us. We all know, right? You guys have a great sense of the pulse of the industry, and what we're all trying to do is get those horses, the Saturday afternoon horses. And I know it's kind of a buzzword, but they are very tough to get, and they're very tough to keep, to stay around. And so we've been excited, it's a small partnership, and Bill Sandberg, who's a West Pointer, who's from Dallas. He's brand new. He's only been in the business for 2 years. He's had some good horses, but certainly this is the best one that he's had. And so we flew him out on, I'm talking about Decorated. We flew him out. You know, there was a big contingent of horses from the East Coast that flew out there. I guess they flew out on Sunday. So, you know, everything's good. It's as good of a race as I think a three-year-old turf race that we've seen all year. You know, all the shooters are there and, you know, but that's what you like, right? Because, you know, we're hoping that it'll set him up for a great four-year-old year. And there's some, there've been some really, really top horses that have knocked the Hollywood Derby off, and we're going to try to be another one, but we got Rosario going out and a Clement, you know, he's had a, I guess a career year. You know, I know you guys talk about him a lot, and he's, you know, he's got some pep in his step, and Miguel, his son, is really, really evolved into a key man in that operation, and they've got great people. So, you know, it's a lot of fun to be on a winning team, right? And, but they're tough to get a hold of, and we're really proud, and, you know, it's great to have this horse under our roof and in our stable.
Anybody else this weekend you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I got a call from Dale Romans yesterday, and he had Jake Romans in the we're running a good quality road Lady Traveler in the stake in the Golden Ride on Saturday, and his son is the agent for Joe Talamo. So I've got my trainer in the tack room with his son, who's a jocks agent, and they spun me. So Jake is gonna ride a Brad Cox horse. I said, who the hell is Brad Cox? But, you know, it just works out. But I just thought it was ironic. I wish there was a video there. I said, I couldn't kind of create this thing in a Hollywood script. I get spun by my trainer's son. So, but, you know, Brad's going to New Orleans. I think Joe's going to Oaklawn and the fairgrounds, and we're going to Gulfstream. So I give it to Jake, you know, who's also a rising star in the business, but I appreciate the fact that he, you know, he had the gumption to stand up and say, Dad, I'm going to spin you. So go figure. And Dallas has a cool horse by the name of Arabian Prince, who's going to run in the colt, the 2-year-old colt stake at Churchill. And the final horse is my boy Jack, who had coming off a long layoff out on the West Coast at Del Mar in the race going a mile and a half, or actually a mile and a 16th. And, you know, we're excited to get him back, Keith DeSormo. So we own that horse with Saul and a couple other real good partners. So, you know, we're trying to stay at it. You know, it's a tough game. It's a grinding game, but, you know, when you have like a weekend like this to look forward to, you know, it really, really brings a lot of a great anticipation. And, you know, it's really the essence of what owning horses is all about.
Yeah. Big weekend for sure. And we'll be rooting for you guys. We're not supposed to root, but we have a soft spot for you guys, obviously, with all the support you've given us. We'll be rooting for you. Terry, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. And for all the insights as well.
Absolutely. My pleasure, guys. Keep up the great work.
Well done. Thank you. Right back at you.
You're well. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Terry Finley will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back with this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, the Keeneland Digital Sale runs December 15th, and entries are open until December 4th. Learn more at keenelanddigital.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Terry Finley, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Aaliyah LaRocca and Danny Seiper. Thank you so much for watching. Have a great Thanksgiving. wear a mask. We'll see you next week.